mitochondria. Now, I know most of you heard this word from me, probably, unless you heard it in school or unless you are professionals in the medical institutions, etc. But it seems like mitochondria is maybe the most crucial thing we should know regarding our health. So without further ado, we're going to dive very quickly to a conversation and probably a fascinating interview with Dr. Mel Litman. Stay with us. Please share this podcast. Thank you very much. Mel Litman, how are you doing, Mel?
Very well, thank you.
Excellent. It's good to have you. And before we kind of go forward, I just to mention, so people can be on the same page with us. Actually, Mel and I never met, although we live very close to one another. Mel is in Yavniel, as well as I am in Yavniel. So we still haven't met in person, but probably after this video, we should. Mm-hmm. I came across actually your wife and we started to discuss your work. And when I said mitochondria, she was like, exactly, that's what it does. And I'm like, let's talk. So it took us a few months, a couple of months, I think. But here we are. And it will be great if you can share with the audience some of your credentials. And then we dive straight into the subjects, which are autoimmune diseases, neurodegenerative diseases, metabolic diseases, etc., which is the main pandemic, we should say, at the moment, for the last, I don't know, 10, 20 years. Yes, stage is yours, mate. Go ahead.
Okay. I mean, just in terms of my own background, I graduated the University of Toronto Medical School back in 1980. Actually, when they had their 40th reunion, it was during COVID, they had to cancel that. But I've been in practice that many years. When I first started, though, I was actually working in a special program of the University of Toronto Medical School that was providing healthcare to the Native communities in the north of Canada. So it was actually a program run by the University of Toronto, but it was in remote areas, and we had our own hospital. We had to fly around to the different communities. It was interesting when I met the doctor who started the program. He was actually the head of pediatrics at Sick Children's Hospital, and he told me there's two reasons why he wanted to start this program. He said one, he wanted to provide healthcare to the communities, the remote communities. He said the other thing, though, is he wanted to rotate his residents from Sick Children's Hospital to the hospital that we had in Sioux Lookout.
Right.
The reason was, he said, you know, we're here, we're in one of the leading, teaching hospitals in the world for pediatrics. We have everything here. We have all the equipment. We have all the diagnostic stuff. He said, what happens now is the residents, a kid comes in and they just run them through all the tests and wait for the test to give them the answer.
Yeah.
He said, you're going to send them up there where they don't have it. And they actually have to sit down, talk to the parents, examine the kids, and try to figure out what's going on. They're forced to think.
Hmm.
So it was actually, and this was back 40 years ago. I mean, this is... So even at that point, there was a concern that doctors were losing that diagnostic ability, the ability to figure things out.
Now they almost lost it.
Which has only gotten worse since that time.
Yes, yes, yes.
But what was good for me, though, is that being in a situation like that where so we ran the hospital ourselves, we were kind of the end of the line, basically. We had no, specialist down the hall that we could send people. So again, we pretty much had to do everything ourselves. But when you're in that position, you start learning very quickly, what's working and what's not working. You got to see, in terms of our our medical training, what was providing good results. And that was mainly in the emergency field. people with acute illnesses, people with trauma. These were the places where we had good tools, to offer.
Yeah. And just a compliment for the whole medical field, when it comes to trauma and acute situations, it's brilliant. I mean, the tools and the remedies that they can give and actually save lives, it's amazing. It never done probably in the past. But we're not here to speak about that and to compliment them. not to go down on them, but just to focus on what's really important.
Right. And that's again what we were seeing. We were seeing that they can come in after a car accident. We had some good tools for them. But then we're seeing the chronic illnesses. Then we're starting to see some of the stuff that we weren't getting such good results for. And that's when I started looking for other tools. So I started training in some other things. I learned first acupuncture. I learned some manual manipulation. I actually went into sports medicine for a while and was working, very physically with injury, chronic pain, and trying to add different tools for that. And then after that, we saw that, okay, we added all these other tools and we were helping another group of people that we couldn't help before. Mm-hmm. And then I went into psychotherapy for a number of years. For about 15, 20 years. And that was going after another aspect of health, what's going on in the brain.
Yes.
And then we were able to go after another group of issues that, again, we weren't dealing with before. Mm. And that actually led me into the area that I've been mostly involved in the last 20 years, which we call orthomolecular medicine. Mm-hmm. So orthomolecular medicine is, I don't know if you've heard of the term before, most people here haven't, but it's an international organization now. It's actually a word invented by Linus Pauling, who was one of the leading biochemists of the 20th century. But later in his life, he got interested in nutritional biochemistry. Mm-hmm. And he actually invented the word orthomolecular medicine and did a paper on it in one of the leading science journals years ago. Hmm. And he said, we're going to define a new area of medicine that we're going to call orthomolecular medicine. And the word itself means the correct molecules.
Right.
So the idea was you're going to put into the body the substances that the body needs in order to heal and to function properly.
Yes.
You would think that would be logical, but that's that was considered pretty radical.
Yeah.
So that means we're using, vitamins, minerals, diet, other modalities, hormone balance, again, everything involves the way that the body operates optimally.
But obviously you, at the same time that you put like good stuff in the body, you remove or you decrease the bad stuff, consuming less of the bad stuff and putting less of it in the body, right?
Right. And that was even a word that they gave. They called it toxi-molecular.
There you go. I put now on the screen, that's normally what I put on my screen. It says at the top left, sur mera asetov. It's only part of a sentence, which means step away from evil and do good, which goes with what you just said, because it's reduce the evil stuff or the bad stuff that comes into your body and try to deal or inhale or input good things into your body, the right molecules, like you say.
Right. And you're right that it involves both sides.
Yes.
It involves, first of all, trying to avoid putting the toxic stuff into the body. And once it's in the body, getting it out again.
Yes.
So that's one nutritional the nutritional cancer doctor, he put it very simply. He says, you bring in the groceries and take out the garbage.
Fair enough. it's quite funny because say it again, orthomolecule?
Yeah, orthomolecular.
Orthomolecular, all right.
Yeah.
Even that...
Again, ortho just means correct.
Yes, I understand that. So even that, you deal with people or you treat people who are coming to see you after probably they already have a problem that obviously surface and they aware of it, so they suffer from something. And maybe also they visited other doctors before you, and maybe things didn't work out as planned, maybe didn't work out at all, and they still seek for a solution. Now, when they come and see you, the problem is already in a way acute, because it's here and now, and you have to deal with it here and now in order for the patient or for the human being who comes to see you can live or can suffer less and keep on living. And this is like really crucial and acute stuff. It's not, yes, we deal with maybe autoimmune diseases or some sort of other diseases, but the situation is acute to that extent that they come and see you and they need the treatment here and now. So the way you treat them, and we go to it in a second, the way you treat them is, you will detail it in a second. My emphasis is not on that, is not on treating people. Also, of course, not that I'm not a healer, I'm not a therapist, I'm not a doctor, that's why I interview you. My emphasis is not on that. My emphasis is more on living in the right way. Maybe if you like automolecular in the right way while you live, not when you discover that you have a sickness or some sort of disease in the body or in the brain. So what I discovered, and I discovered this through conversations and lectures and essays and blog posts by Dr. Jack Cruz, a neurosurgeon from the States, and Dr. Laszlo Boros, a biochemist from Hungary, but he ran in the past until Corona. He ran the UCLA lab in California, etc. And they, in a way, they are friends as well as teachers. And what I realized is that mitochondria has a very crucial part in our health, in our well-being, in our levels of energy, in hormones production, in the if you like, the photosynthesis of the body, which is the mitochondrial respiration, etc. And yes, it involves also the right molecule. I mean, it involves the right molecule. My emphasis is on the surroundings of our life, our daily life. That means the right light that we have around us, and the right water that we have in the body and outside of it, and the right EMF, the native or the natural electromagnetic fields that creation has given us. But once someone has not properly lived according to these structures or laws of physics, then maybe a problem is arising, and then they come and seek for a solution and they may reach you. So how, in a way, if I can ask, how you, given your knowledge of mitochondrial functioning and the right molecules that one has to take in the body, how you combine this together and how you help people? And I know I've heard a lot, not just from your wife, about how much help you give to people. And I think it's amazing. And that's why you are here, because you actually make a change in the world. So again, thank you for that. And if you can just, tell us how you do it.
Okay. I mean, so the ideal patient that I would get would be one who I see before they're sick.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
It's much easier to prevent it than to reverse it.
Yes.
So that's the ideal. But that's not who I often see. Again, most of the time I'm seeing people who have been sick for a while and have been through the system and tried a lot of different things already.
Yes.
So that tends to be more my typical patient that I'm seeing. But a lot of it sort of, we kind of put a lot of these different things together once we understood the mitochondria better.
Yes.
So that was kind of a unifying factor for, you know, how we're going to treat people in a lot of different ways. So the mitochondria, most of us know mitochondria because it's our main energy production in the cells. So that's where we're getting the energy for the cell to do whatever job it needs to do. And by the way, cells that need the most energy have the most mitochondria. So when you're dealing with, So the brain and the heart need a lot of energy. You know, hopefully these things are working all the time. But the
yes, hopefully.
In the brain, I mean, these neurons in the brain, they have many thousands of mitochondria per cell.
Yes.
And it's a lot of work, to all the electrical activity, the neurotransmitter production, all these kind of things. It takes a lot of energy. So you might not be able to see it, but it's working. But I said that's the kind of the job of the mitochondria when we're in our healthy state. Mm-hmm. So again, it's providing the energy. It's actually doing a lot of other regulation, like you said, hormone production, other forms of communication between cells. A lot of these are being directed by mitochondria. Mm. So again, all of the way that we're functioning when we're working well. But then we're also finding that the mitochondria is the main director of our response to damage. And what we see is that damage, which can come from many different sources. I mean, this could be physical trauma. It can be chemical poisons, toxins. It can be infections. It could be EMF. I mean, all these different kinds of things are going to be a toxin to the cells. They're going to create damage. And there was actually a group in California who for many years, I mean, their whole focus has been on researching mitochondria. It's led by a fellow named Robert, I think he pronounced his last name, Navo. And they've been doing a lot of the research, and they've defined what they call the cell danger response. They're looking at the mechanism of what happens in the mitochondria when some kind of harmful event happens. And they found that immediately the mitochondria shift their function. They shift from their normal thing of, again, the energy production, communication, all this kind of, and they completely change their function. And they change their shape and structure, like very quickly. They actually become, there's a whole other job description for them now.
Wow.
And now their job description is to respond. You respond to the danger. And again, it doesn't matter so much what form it takes. The response a lot is really similar. And usually the initial response that you get is inflammation. Hmm. So that's kind of like, we have a danger here. Let's bring in the army. Let's get it under control. And that's like the initial response. That's where you get, if you had an injury, that's where you're going to get the swelling and the pain and, the signs of the response of the inflammation. Mm-hmm. And then once things are under control, they change again. Now the mitochondria make another shift. And they go more into a repair and rebuilding. So cells that may have been lost have to be replaced and structures have to be repaired. And they go into this rebuilding state. And then it goes into a third stage where now that you've dealt with the main issues, now the cells have to return back into their functional state of what they're there for in the first place. So now they have to start reconnecting, communicating to the other cells and the other tissues and going back to their role that they're supposed to be functioning in.
Yes.
If you had a muscle cell that was injured and now it was just dealing with the injury at first, it wasn't working as a muscle cell anymore.
Yeah.
It was just working as a repair. And now it has to go back to its job. So now, again, it has to reestablish the communication, reestablish its original functioning. And that's when you kind of completed the repair process. And they're finding that pretty much all of our chronic diseases are when we don't go through this repair process properly. Mm-hmm. It gets stopped somewhere. And the attempt, with the unsuccessful attempt at repairing is what we call our diseases.
Right. And what are the reasons for a unsuccessful repair, for example?
It could be a number of things. One is that you still may have the same assault coming.
All right.
Yeah. You know, if you're continuing to shove poisons into your body, you're continuing this cell danger response. You haven't eliminated what was setting it off in the first place.
Yes.
The other thing is that some of the processes, a lot of biochemical processes that are taking place inside the cell. And again, there's things that could be interrupted. And sometimes you get into a more complicated, almost feedback loops. Because the cells themselves send out danger signals that continues the response.
Yes.
But if it doesn't shut them down properly, or again, it can get into kind of like a vicious cycle. So sometimes even when the original danger is not there, the signal is still being produced. This is a lot like what you'll see with PTSD.
Interesting. Interesting.
And in fact, a lot of our diseases are kind of like PTSD of the mitochondria, where the cells are staying on alert as if the danger was still in front of you, but it's not.
It's not. And why that happens?
Like I said, there's been something that didn't allow the normal processing to take place.
So this day after day after day after day may evolve into an autoimmune disease, or
right. So where they're working on this. This is something in progress right now, so they're trying to to sort this out better, because we see that if things don't get past the initial stage, then we often get autoimmune diseases. The inflammatory response is persisting. And that often will lead to like an autoimmune type of situation. If you know, in the repair and the regrowth, and if that part of the process is not being fulfilled properly, then you actually get into things like cancers and diabetes. I mean, there was an interesting paper actually that was done long before we actually knew all this stuff about the mitochondria. I think it was back in the 1980s or so. There is a paper that was called Cancer, A Wound That Doesn't Heal. And they were looking at what goes on in cancer, you know, just the way cancer operates.
Yeah.
And they're saying, well, you know, when you have a wound, when you have an injury, again, your body responds by turning on all kinds of genes. This is what the mitochondria does too. So the mitochondria signals the DNA to turn on genes to help with the repair process. So the mitochondria isn't doing it all, but it's directing a lot of the process. They said when you're dealing with cancer, these genes that are being turned on are, again, the genes that we want in order to repair the damage. Again, they're things that are involved in inflammation and cell growth and all this kind of stuff. But it doesn't finish. It doesn't get turned off. And these same genes, really, that we call repair genes are ones that we call cancer genes.
So they keep on working.
They're not turned off.
Yes.
So it keeps trying to fix something. It keeps creating the inflammation and cell growth, and it keeps going and going.
And they create the damage now. I mean,
and they're creating the damage. And I said the other part of it, like I said, when they're in this process, they're also deaf to the surrounding tissues. So they're not listening. So that, you know, you might have other cells too that also communicate and say, okay, you're done. You know, you can turn off the process, but they don't hear it anymore.
Yeah.
So they're really going autonomously. They're like disconnected now from the rest of the body, and they're just doing their thing. This is an example of again how the repair process has gone wrong, and now we have a deadly disease in place of a repair.
First of all, it's fascinating. I mean, the CDR, the cell danger response, is a new field as far as I understand.
Yes.
And I see, just to say, there's some people are greeting you, just to say, here in the comments. And also, there's some questions, and we'll go to them in a bit. I want, if you can, let's zoom out for a second, because most of us, look, I've discovered what I'm about to ask or to have you speak of. I discovered it in, I think it was 2015. And I was quite shocked from the fact I didn't know it, and from the fact that doctors or professionals, they also unaware of it. And what I'm referring to is mitochondria, obviously, or the mitochondrial, the importance of mitochondria and its functions in the body. Mm-hmm. Because what you just described is one thing or two things, that that mitochondria and mitochondrion is one, and mitochondria is multiple. And like you said, in the brain, we have a few thousands of mitochondria in one cell, as well as the heart. And in other parts, we have maybe 1,000, even 500 mitochondria in one cell. And it has a totally different DNA, and it creates water in the body. It gives us the energy. It communicates. It's like a sensor for the surroundings. That's why the mechanism of the CDR. And I discovered these things about the mitochondria in 2015 and more, not just that. And I was like, whoa, how come I didn't know about it? And obviously it's a rhetoric question, because the medical institutions, in a way, they work with the corporations who give the funds to research, etc. And most doctors or most institutions or medical institutions, they work with what is being, you know, shoved down their throat. Yeah. Basically, most people, they know about the DNA, our genome, and the DNA and its function, you know, for mother and father, etc. They don't know so much about the energy production or the importance of mitochondria or mitochondria functions. And, you know, someone is going to a doctor and he run a test and say, yeah, what you have is genetic. And actually, it's total BS. It's not, and it's reversible, and you can do a lot of things with stuff that they tell us. Most of the time it's in genetics, and you have to deal with it. You just take this medicine all your life and you're good. And it's a lot of it is false. At least I'm saying it, not you. So I'm saying it. I'm not a doctor. Yeah. I can say it on this whole field. And I would like, if you can, to just give us like a larger scope about mitochondria functions in the body. How important is to acknowledge the functions of mitochondria, and then maybe how to improve our, you know, livelihood by giving attentions to what is more important than the genetic pool, you know, the genome we have in the nucleus, and more so what we should do in order to give more importance and more credit to what the mitochondria do in the body. Yeah.
Okay. It's interesting, in terms of a lot of these we think of as genetic diseases.
Yes.
Because one of the first studies that this group in California did, they were defining the CDR and all this, was with autism.
Right.
And I don't know if you've seen that, the work with that. It's just starting. Mm-hmm. But autism also is, in the medical world in general, it says, okay, you got this genetic problem and that's all there is to it, and there's nothing you can do about it except maybe we can give you a few drugs to try to control some symptoms here.
Which is false.
Right. So what they did is they were actually looked at he said he looked at pretty much every drug that was like available, like more than 2,000 drugs in the world, and looked at the effects on the mitochondria. And he found one out of all the drugs that exist right now in the world that had this positive effect in the mitochondria of turning off the danger signal.
Right.
The initiation of the process.
Mm-hmm.
So it was interfering with it looked like both the production of some of the danger chemicals and the receptors for them on the cells.
Mm-hmm.
So he's looking at, so now we're going to turn off the message, the danger message. And they took a small group of autistic kids, and they gave them one injection of this stuff. And they said for the next 6 weeks, they started speaking, interacting. They started these incurable autistic symptoms started disappearing.
Wow.
Now they started recurring again after that.
Yes.
But again, so they wanted to, you know, go on with a larger study and do repeated shots and see if we can maintain the benefit. But again, the idea was, is that we're treating what was supposed to be an untreatable genetic abnormality, and we're showing you can make changes.
Yes.
Again, if we can get at the other thing too that I found, even just, you know, through the years, just looking at almost every actual genetic neurodegenerative disease that I've looked at, these things that are, you know, killing usually children at young ages, they just, you know, degenerate and go into comas or whatever. They're finding almost all of them, there's issues with mitochondria.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I mean, I'm surprised from the information, but I'm not surprised from the principalities, because I know it to be true, and it's good to hear it from a professional, you know, from a doctor and not just me. That's excellent. Thank you. Go on, please.
And I just want to shift a little bit to just to get another view of it.
Sure.
You know, sort of tie together some different things.
Please do.
Also, because of all my years in psychotherapy, you know, I've looked at what's going on in the thinking and emotions and, you know.
Psychic, yes.
Yes. So I'm not sure if you're familiar also with the polyvagal theory.
No, I don't think so.
Okay, this is kind of a newer theory of, mostly they're using it in terms of looking at psychological trauma. Again, they're looking like a lot with PTSD, these kind of things. They call it the polyvagal theory because they're looking at actually three different parts of the autonomic nervous system, you know, our system that's regulating us, you know, just, they said autonomic just means automatically. So it's not something we're controlling directly, but our nervous system has its own, its own program and on how to respond. Yes. So they found with this is that, there was, usually we talked about the sympathetic parasympathetic nervous system.
Yes.
The main parasympathetic nerve is the vagal nerve. The vagus nerve is the main parasympathetic one, you know, going from the brain into the chest, into the abdomen. It's our main parasympathetic control of our organs.
Which also has a lot of mitochondria in it. I mean, it's the third.
Oh, no. Yes, yes.
I think after the brain, the heart, it's the vagus nerve that has the most of mitochondria. Maybe I'm wrong, but I remember.
Yeah, it usually goes the brain and the heart and muscles in general, but heart even more so.
Yes.
Yes,
please go ahead. Sorry, I'll keep quiet. Okay.
No, so what they found with the vagus nerve, though, is that the vagus nerve actually wasn't one nerve. There are different parts to it and actually doing kind of opposite functions. So normally we think of the sympathetic side of the nervous system as the fight, flight, you know, this is why responding to a danger. You know, so you're turning on the adrenaline and cortisol and all of the stuff that you need in order to deal with some emergency in front of you. The vagus is the other side, is the calming, you know, that's the one, when you're digesting your food and sleeping, and like, you have the vagus nerve that's, you know, the balance to that. But they found there was another part, which actually an older part of the vagus nerve, that is also involved in danger. And it's actually the one that shuts down the system. It actually shuts down your nervous system. And this is actually a very primitive one. They find this in reptiles, you know, this original vagus nerve. You know, where you see them freeze, you know, when they're in some danger, they freeze, you know, there's no movement. It's a survival tool. And somebody as an example, someone once described, I think it was some scene from National Geographic. You know, there was in Africa, and there was a herd of something, you know, gazelles, something like that, you know, or, you know, happily, you know, in their herd feeding, you know, having a good time, eating the grass and the weeds. And then a lion comes along that wants dinner. So this lion comes, and the lions usually want to go for whoever's going to be the easiest. You know, they don't not necessarily looking for a challenge. They'll go for whatever's easiest to get. Mm-hmm. So there was a small. So these animals start running, and then it was one of the young animals who wasn't able to keep up with them. So the lion was going to go for them. And this animal knows it. They know they're trapped. They're not going to get away. And then this other part of the vagus nerve shuts them down. And they just collapse and they look like they're dead. And apparently, lions don't like dead things. They like to kill them themselves.
Yes.
So they see this dead one and they go, all right, I'll go over. So I'll leave this one and go for some fresh stuff.
Yeah.
And then so this thing that was you know almost killed, that was like paralyzed, hardly breathing. So a few minutes later, it gets up, you know, runs back to the herd, joins it, and it's everything's fine again.
Alive and kicking. You see this quite a lot with cats, which obviously the same family as lions. Cats, they're best hunters, you know, and what they hunt is moving creatures, not still creatures. So what they do is, you know, they play with the hand, and then let's say it's a beetle, okay? So the beetle moves, and then they kind of thump it, and then the beetle stops. And then the cat is looking away a bit, but still can see with the angle of his eye if there's a movement. He's checking with the peripheral sight if there's movement. Now, if there's movement, then he will go for it. If there's no movement, he will try again to move it to see if it's alive, if it's moving. And if it doesn't, the cat will go because he's bored now because he has nothing to hunt. And what you describe now is the same mechanism as I see almost on a daily basis with my cats trying to hunt whatever, you know, just it's part of their way. It's what they do. They are hunters. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I just, reflecting this.
Yeah, and it's interesting that they see that these basic reflexes are right from, you know, reptiles, mammals, you know, it's been there for, you know, early times.
For survival.
It's fight,
flight, freeze. So this is the freeze.
Exactly.
This is the freeze side of the vagus nerve. Yes. All right. Interesting.
Yeah.
Really interesting.
And again, what's supposed to happen is you deal with the fight, flight, or freeze. And then again, once the danger is dealt with, now you go back to the other vagal part, what they refer to as the ventral vagal part of the nerve, comes from a different center in the brain, the two parts of the vagus. Hmm. They run in the same nerve, but they're actually coming from originating in different parts of the brain.
Yeah.
And then you're supposed to go back to this. And this one they often refer to as safety and connection when you're in that vagal part. You know, that's when you're with a group. There's no dangers. You're connecting with the other people. This is the healthy state.
Yes.
This is the state where, again, you're back into your role as part of the group. You know, you're functioning as, you know, cooperatively with the group. And it said they usually use the words safe and connected.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the state that we want to be in a lot more of the time.
Of course.
But if you don't turn off, you know, the fight, flight, and freeze stuff, then you're stuck in this PTSD state. And I said, in the PTSD state, you're also misreading signals. You know, instead of somebody shooting at you, you know, any loud sound is setting you off, even though there's no danger to it.
Yes.
Or even certain symbolic visual things, you know, that were related to the original trauma, but are not.
Yes.
You know, so all kinds of things that can set it off and maintain this alarm state. And when you're in the alarm state, you can't function the way you're supposed to. I said you can function both, you know, when you're in defense, you know, you can't do, again, your other jobs, again, the same way as the mitochondria. They're not doing their energy production functions when they're in repair and inflammation processes. So you can't do everything at the same time. So even when you look at some of the tools that have been used to try to work with PTSD, you know, there are things that came out like EMDR, you know, the eye movement desensitization. Mm-hmm. There was what I think is an advance on that they call brain spotting. And there's other, what they call somatic emotional techniques, where you're working with the nervous system. And what they, when they came up, started the EMDR, what their theory was, is that when they were doing whatever process they were doing, they were allowing the nervous system to complete its processing. You're allowing it to finish the processing that it was in, that it got stuck in, and now it's allowing it to process it through. So it's the same idea again, like with the mitochondria, it has to complete the healing process in order for things to go back to a healthy state. So even psychologically, we're looking at doing a similar thing. He said, so, and these are just different tools that help to access the nervous system, you know, to again, to put it in a state where it's allowed to process again. In psychiatry now, there's also some newer work going on in psychiatry, where they're looking at mitochondria, the function, as being connected to all the serious psychiatric diseases, schizophrenia, bipolar, all the depressions. They're finding that the mitochondria are connected to all these different emotional states too. And one of the treatments they started doing to try to affect the mitochondria was a ketogenic diet.
Of course.
Organic, hopefully.
Hopefully, yeah, yes.
So that you're, and the ketogenic diet they found was doing really interesting things.
Important to have, by the way, grass-fed, because it's doing the photosynthesis, process. This is in the ketogenic diet. It's organic, yeah. But grass-fed. I mean, it's important.
Right, you know? Right. No. It's a whole different food.
Yes, exactly. It's like the old food. It's like the Amish food, you know, if you like. It's the original food. And, you know, Dr. Yeah. Laszlo Boros has been doing extensive research about the Bible and mitochondria or ketogenic diet. I think it will be fascinating if I'll hook both of you together, because it's really fascinating stuff that he found in the Bible regarding, you know, deuterium depleted water, mitochondria, and the whole food chain that is written in the Bible. It actually goes hand in hand with mitochondria. Yeah. Fascinating. Yeah. Yeah, go on.
I mean, we were designed for this to work together.
Yes.
So what they were started doing with the ketogenic diet, and they were looking at what that does in mitochondria. And it had some really interesting effects in the mitochondria, not just in the function. It does help with the function, but it also helps with a couple of other processes, including what they call mitophagy, which means breaking down and getting rid of damaged mitochondria.
Yes.
And then producing more healthy mitochondria. So it was actually involved in the real, you know, basic foundation of cleaning things up. You know, let's get rid of some of the dysfunctional stuff, get some healthy stuff in there. So the ketogenic diet was even affecting that level. Fasting, you know, probably even more so, which is like, you know, super ketogenic.
Yes.
but that was doing it. But they said the ketogenic diet, or another way, sort of a compromise, is intermittent fasting, which is also becoming more popular, mm-hmm. where you're limiting your food intake to whatever, 6 hours in the day, yeah. and you're fasting the rest of the day. And it also is giving some of these same benefits. Mm-hmm. And sometimes dramatic changes in severe stuff like schizophrenia, and their delusions and, you know, hallucinations, you're actually having significant effects by affecting the mitochondria. So again, we're seeing this on multiple levels. You know, on the psychological level, again, you're trying to do it again through this process of going, you know, to the nervous system and trying to help that retune itself. And so that's where, again, when some of these other techniques. It was interesting too when they developed some of these techniques, because originally they were trying to use like regular psychotherapy for PTSD, and it wasn't working very well.
Surprise!
One of the original pioneers in the whole field, Besser van der Kolk. I don't know if you've come across his name. He was really one of the pioneering guys. So he said, well, after they looked at things like the polyvagal theory and some of these other mechanisms going on in the nervous system, he said, well, it looks like we're trying to use language, you know, to get at these issues for something that occurred when the whole language center was shut down. When you're in these alarm states, you turn off the language centers in the brain because your body's not considered, you know, it's not concerned with having a conversation.
Sure.
You know, it's concerned with, you know, staying alive.
Yeah.
It actually physically shuts down the centers in the brain. So he said, so we're trying to, you know, use verbal communication to go after something that was turned off at the time of the trauma.
Hmm.
So they were using physical approaches, trying to get into the nervous system physically and access it that way. So it's interesting, you know, that the methods, you know, that we have to use to access and, you know, and create the changes. I said, but in all of these cases, the final step is always a reintegration. You have to go back into your, you know, your state where you are, again, in the community, functioning within the community in a productive way. You have to go back to that kind of state. And if you don't make that last step, then that's where they see a lot of the psychiatric illnesses are.
Hmm.
You haven't completed it. Even the school of psychology that I mostly studied, which was Adler, that was my foundation. But with Adler, he even defined mental illness and mental health by a term that they translated into English. They called social interest, which is a bad term. But what it really meant was your connectedness, your sense of contribution to a community. And he said, you know, the more you have that sense of connection and contribution, the more mentally healthy you are. And the less you have of that, the more mentally ill you are. To even use that as a definition of them, this is 100 years ago, he was using this as a definition.
Yeah.
But we see how that actually ties in directly to the mitochondria. The mitochondria are healthy, you know, when they're doing their job within a community of cells within the body.
I noticed that from, let's say, workshops that I've done with many people, as well as people who are following the advices on how to maintain a healthy mitochondria functions, let's say, that the results depends on who we speak about and what's his state or situation, of course. Still, with that, the results are coming quite fast. Unlike dealing with symptoms,
mm-hmm.
here, because it's the mitochondria and you address the actual root cause of the symptom or disease that one has, when you deal with that and you help the mitochondria to function better,
yes,
things start to get better. Generally speaking, things start to get better much faster, less symptoms, like you described with the autistic children. Okay, it's not like going out and watching the sunrise. They gave them injections with a drug that suppress less the CDR, etc. But still... Yeah. When you deal with the root cause, which is in a way the mitochondria, that's why I think I find it so important to tell people about mitochondria in the body, because when you start to give this attention to mitochondria in your own body, mm-hmm. in a in a physical way, in a biochemical way, in your food, in light, surroundings and everything, the results are really surprisingly fast. And how can you, me, we encourage more people to address that? Because the habitual, you know, our habit is to go to the doctor or to go to a therapist, do something right with me, instead right of changing my own habits and learning. And even now in this conversation, people hear it and they're like, it's quite simple things to do. I mean, okay, not everyone will take an injection now and put it, but although many people have done it just recently, but that's a whole different thing. But some things are so simple to follow and to have and to use and to have a new healthier habits to improve your daily functions, because you improve or you address the mitochondria and you help the mitochondria to function better, and that gives you the overall improvement. So how can we do that? How can we help people to do that in an you know, easy ways, let's say?
Okay. Well, actually, it's also an interesting thing about the way we do most of our medical treatments. So it's in a way, it's a little bit paradoxical in the sense mostly we're using medications to control some symptoms of the problem.
Exactly. Yes, yes.
But a lot of these medications, maybe even most of the medications, have negative effects on the mitochondria. So the drugs are controlling symptoms, but they're not healing. And if anything, they're not only not promoting the healing process, they may be interfering with it because of the negative effects that they would have in the mitochondria.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's not, what we're doing is not a healing approach. You know, it's like it's a symptom maintenance approach.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, so we want to get at the, you know, the actual healing. You know, we want to actually to the repair, and then I said, and get into the healthy functioning state. That's where we want to go with it.
Yes.
Just to make things even a little weirder, you know, you can even go as far as, Matthias Desmet, who developed the mass formation theories. Who's involved in, you're familiar with that?
No, I don't think so. Please enlighten me.
Okay. It's a very interesting work. He's a psychologist in, I think he's in Belgium. Mm-hmm. But he's been working very long time with this this whole area, what they call mass formation, which sometimes they added another term calling it mass formation psychosis. So he's saying, so how do you put a whole population kind of into a hypnotic state? And you're saying, well, the first thing you need is to create constant fear. I mean, the reason this theory became so popular is because of what went on with the corona process.
Of course.
So he said he was trying to explain what went on in the world, in the population.
Mm-hmm.
He says, well, the first thing is you have to, you know, have fear. You have to have the danger response. And he said, you have to keep, you know, and you have to maintain it. So you have to keep pumping out constant fear messages. And he said, the second thing, though, is you have to also disconnect people. So you need to, you know, put them in isolation and make them afraid of contact with other people. He said, when you get into this fear and detached state, then you're actually putting people into what he calls like almost like a delusional state, into a... They refer to it as a mass formation, is that the whole population is going into a certain kind of belief system. And he says, what's the solution to that is to get people involved in small communities. You know, small supportive communities.
How the neighbor. Yes, go on,
yes.
Sorry.
So what we're looking at is, you know, what's going on in a cell, what's going on in our brains, and what's going on in society.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all kind of mirroring the same processes.
Macro, micro, yes, yep. Same, yep. Yes, yep. Same mechanism, yes. Just, someone just wrote, few minutes ago, Sheena, I put her comment here. The fear-mongering of the pandemic has frozen so many into no action, like you said before, that no action, yeah, the freeze state, to save themselves.
Yes.
Which is true. And now you just, you know, just emphasized it by saying the mass formation. Actually, now that you detailed it, I remember I read about it. This just published, I don't know, a year ago or something like that. I mean,
he actually published a book on it like a couple of months ago. It's pretty
so new. Maybe a couple of months ago. I don't remember, but I came across it. And the thing is, I don't remember it because it's so obvious to me that this is how it works. I mean, when the corona started and I did my broadcasts, I was trying to tell people, you are under a spell. I mean, what happens now is with the fear and the flickering light from the screens and the radiation and the subject that it's an enemy that you cannot see. So you suspect everyone that may infect you and all this bullshit. Yeah. So, and you are under a spell and they're just making you being afraid and separating you without reading this guy, you know, essay or work about mass formation. It was quite obvious to me in my own words what is happening. And I try to explain as many people as I can what is going on. Luckily, some people did listen and they kind of said, okay, we got it. Okay, that's, you know, they don't believe the pandemic, etc. Yes.
No, and he was using this, the title of his book was actually The Psychology of Totalitarianism. And he was looking at, and he was looking at the same process as really the same strategy that went on with Hitler and Stalin, and they're using the same tools, basically.
Yeah, same lady, different address. So
Yeah. But I said, it's again, it's, you know, the issue again at all levels is keeping us in the danger state.
Which is true. I mean, if I take just Israel for an example, just for now, for a little bit, and then we'll leave it. But the whole situation of, I mean, there's a mass experiment being done here since the establishment of the state of Israel, or the cooperation of the state of Israel, is wars, terror acts, wars, bombs, wars, terror, and all that. You have to be afraid, because through this fear, we can control you and maneuver you to do whatever we want you to do. So in other countries, they didn't have that so much, maybe. You know, some more, some less. Mm-hmm. But in Israel, it's quite in your face.
Right. Now, it's a constant. It's in the consciousness all the time.
Yes, yes. And now they do it again with Jerusalem. There's now stuff happening. I mean, for those of us here in this broadcast from England, from Australia, there's a few people from various countries. Just now, today, yesterday, emergency declared in Jerusalem due to whatever, terror acts, war acts. Stuff is happening as we speak, bombs and stuff like that, just so you know, from Ireland as well. All right. So it's while we speak, it's getting on. It's not something that was in the past. It's constant, like you just said. Yes. One question, because probably some people here, and obviously I published your website, of course, some people here have questions and they may want to know more, and they may have some issues and they may want some consultancy from you, etc. So they're obviously feel free to go to a website and address you. The question I have is, when someone comes to you, regardless now of the disease that he or she may come about, I mean, first, you need to stop, you need to tell him, I guess, yeah, to stop the bad habits and the bad mm-hmm. consumption of bad stuff, and then start to take the good stuff and the good habits. So can you just describe a bit, not maybe don't tell us everything, keep something private to your patients, but if you can share with us some of the process that someone that's approaching you, how you deal with him or her in helping them.
I mean, mostly it's two things to start with. One is is just get the details of their life. I mean, what's, you know, how they're living.
Yes.
And then you can, then very often just from that, you can see a lot of the issues in terms of the toxic exposures and nutritional deficiencies. And, you know, you'll get a lot of that just by sitting down and talking to them. Mm-hmm. Most, you know, I'll also do a, like a blood test to get a little more specific picture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I'll try to measure, especially what I can. I mean, it's limited in what tests you can actually do here. You know, there was more available in North America, but it's, you can still do some basic stuff.
Yeah, so, but you know, can so go to private labs can do more.
Even there, it's still limited.
So if you want, I can hook you up with someone. That really, seriously, he's one of us, and he can help you if you want to know some more. Just so you know, if you want, I can hook you up. Okay. Go on, sorry.
No, I've been in contact with some of the private labs here, and I asked them, what can you do? I mean, their answer was basically, we can do whatever you want. It depends on how much you want to pay for it. Because if you're doing it in small numbers, the cost of each test is going to be so high that it's not worth it.
Right.
So we're doing stuff that we're going to do because there's a large demand for it.
Mm-hmm.
So some of these others, I mean, certainly there's not a large demand in the medical profession for these tests.
Yeah, because they don't want to look at it.
Yeah, so there might be a few doctors that want these tests, but that's not going to be enough to,
sure,
you know, to make it worthwhile price for them to do it here.
Yeah. Okay, so you run a blood
test. There's basic stuff we do. We can check certain vitamins, minerals. I look at their hormone picture, which is another, you know, powerful part. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the hormones were active on the mitochondria. I mean, that's the target of a lot of them.
Of course.
So, I mean, so we want to look at that whole picture and make sure it's in balance. So we can do that looking at some of the biochemistry, physiology, and then there's, again, just the direct information from them. And usually we can get going with, with a plan from there.
Then what? I mean, what you put them on? I mean, if you can just, you don't, I mean, have to. Go on.
I mean, there's some of the real basics that you would already know, which is, you know, try to get onto a low toxic, nutrient dense diet. I mean, that's kind of the foundation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, try to get as much nutrients and as little poison as you can. And this usually means an organic diet, and usually a broad based organic diet, including the fruits and vegetables and eggs and fish and meat and, you know, the whole spectrum of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Like, so in the old days, you know, when people ask me, then what shall I eat? And I'm like, go back 100 years, 200 years.
Yeah.
What people eat back then, how they live their life, in a way, they got up in the morning because the chicken was like kukuriku and sunrise is there, and you go out and you accept the morning and the sun, and you give some food to the chicken, and you eat what was there. You don't have to eat meat every day, and you don't have to eat fish every day.
Right.
Definitely if it's coming from the industry, you know. So you have to live in a way, in some ways at least, like our grandpa and grandma.
Exactly. No, in fact, the nutrition group that I was most connected with is the Weston Price Foundation.
Excellent. Yes, excellent.
So the Weston Price Foundation. Weston Price Foundation is traditional diets.
From the 30s. I mean, the research is from back then and is still valid. I mean, it's valid for life because it's good. It's
no, and all they looked at was exactly that. They looked at how did people eat when they were healthy, when we didn't have these diseases.
Yes.
And that's the basis of their nutritional advice is traditional foods.
Hmm.
So, you know, back again, when we still ate foods that had nutrients in them, which is getting harder to do.
Yes.
And that were not poisoned. You know, there was no, the toxins weren't there. And I said, yeah, so that's the basis of a diet, you know, to start with. Now, a lot of these people may need other stuff. Again, they may need additional detoxification, usually.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we still want to get stuff out that's been built up over many years,
mm-hmm.
and just try to clean up the body. Now, that'll partly be done with the clean diet, but again, a lot of times we need some extra stuff to, you know, process it faster, you know, to push it along quicker.
And do you use supplements like you recommend?
Yes, I use a lot of stuff. I use a lot of supplements.
So after the cleansing process and getting, you know, removing toxins from the body, you basically people take supplements. I mean, not all of them and not everyone, but
we'll start all at the same time.
Ah,
we're going to start the supplements with the nutrients at the same time. We're using stuff that's helping to detoxify.
Right. Okay. And what sort of supplements? I mean, are they known supplements or?
They're known supplements in terms of the ingredients mostly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're using the vitamins, minerals, the fatty acids, amino acids, if you need to. You're using the basic substances. What I look for though are products that are that fulfill a certain criteria for me. So I want products that first of all are using natural forms of the vitamins and minerals, because those are what the body is designed to work with. Because mm-hmm. there's a lot of synthetic stuff around that doesn't work as well. It'll still work, but it's not going to work as well in general. You also want to get the right doses. It doesn't really do a whole lot, to take a one-a-day multi of synthetic nutrients in small doses. It might even do a little bit, but it's really not going to solve the problem. So I want to use things that are going to give the right forms in the right doses and in the right balance.
Mm-hmm.
You want the right proportions of, all vitamins and minerals work in teams. And in the team, you have maybe a lot of this, but a little bit of this. But you want to use it, stuff that's going to be in the proportions that your body needs them in.
Yes.
So those are the kind of supplements I'm looking at doing. And, more and more I'm using supplements more specific to the mitochondria. So we have certain things that are really critical specifically for mitochondrial function. Again, most of the nutrients are also involved in the mitochondria, but there's certain things that are very specific, things like CoQ10 and PQQ.
Mm-hmm.
These are very important things that are critical for mitochondrial function.
Yeah, to be honest, I've taken CoQ10 for a couple of months. I didn't feel any, not because I had a problem, just because I heard about it and I was like, okay, let's try it. Right. out.
And the time people that feel the most difference are the ones who have a problem.
Need it. Yes. So I didn't, I was like, okay, maybe it works for someone, not for me. I don't know. So luckily.
It also depends on the dose that you're taking. I said dose is really important.
Mm.
Most of the supplements are really too low dose to notice that much with.
Mm-hmm.
If you're taking one of the common, if you're taking a 60 milligram or 100 milligram CoQ10, you probably won't see so much.
Right.
I'm putting people on 400, 600 milligrams a day of CoQ10.
Right.
So we're using much more, significant doses. And then there's another one that I'm using most often now together with it, something they call PQQ.
Yeah.
Which is another kind of partner with CoQ10. But PQQ is even doing some other stuff in terms of helping to regenerate mitochondria, not just the function.
Mm.
And they found, when they did some studies using CoQ10 and PQQ, if you put them together, you got much more effect.
Nice.
If you use the two together.
Okay, nice one.
And then there are also some new things that have been developed that are coming out on the market now that are not very well known, that are CoQ10-like substances, even more powerful.
Right. And these natural sources.
Yeah.
Excellent.
One of the products that I've been starting to use more is it uses like a modified CoQ10 and bound to another natural substance, and they just found that this one was working much more powerfully in the mitochondria. So there is other stuff on the market. There's other things too, like nicotinamide riboside, which is another important mitochondrial support for another part of the process.
Mm-hmm.
So these things are coming out more and more. They're newer on the market. So they're not as well known. And of course, they're expensive.
I think for me, not just for me, for let's say for Israelis, but today with video conferencing, etc., it's really for everywhere. It's important to know that there are doctors like you who actually gives good advice on the root cause of things, and not on the level of symptoms, because we know all that. I mean, the second part, we know about that, but not enough doctors are doing what you do. And that's why I felt inclined to have you on board, so people know you, know your work, know your attitude, where you come from. Because if you come from the medical institutions and you test someone and you hardly look at him and you just write on the computer his dry details, and then you send him to do MMR, CT, whatever tests, and then come back and again I write on the computer, this is wrong for me. But actually what you do is you look at the person who comes over, and you know that you need to deal or to help or to support his mitochondria or her mitochondria. And this is, I know that this is what's important. And it's good to know, first of all, for the Israelis, that you are here in Israel and you can help them. It's really important because Israel is small, and, you know, 1 hour, couple of hours drive, they can come and meet you in person, and you can actually help them and tell them and maybe sell them whatever they need. And it's really important because, as we just said before, it works faster than other things. Mm-hmm. And the second thing, even for people not from Israel, they can still, contact you through the website and ask questions and maybe fix a date or schedule a meeting with you to learn, even from afar, what they can do, because they can run a blood test in their hometown and then send it over to you.
Even in terms of internationally, I actually see people from Canada, the States, Europe, you know, so I have long distance appointments. Sometimes the issue is, getting them to find somebody that will cooperate, with the process there.
Yeah. Again, it's like a new network of people who are focusing on the real solutions, and I'm trying just to hook up people to the right professionals or people to the right people who give the right advice in order to solve the problems, because we, again, habits and brainwashed to work with certain parts of the system, but it's time to find other solutions. And I think, no, I know that the solutions are there. Like people like yourself, they bring the solutions. And people like Laszlo Boss, Dr. Jack Cruz, and other people in Israel who actually deal with the right solutions. And I want, if you can, you don't have to, but if you can and willing to, let's say someone took these corona shots, all right, and is having some issues. Whatever the issues are, I'm not going into them now, but can they come over, and is it possible that you can help them?
I'm already seeing that.
So that's people who with some poisons in their body recent injections, yes?
Yeah, and also you may be shocked to hear, but the spike protein that's produced by the, by the vaccine goes into the mitochondria and damages it.
I'm not shocked to hear that. Excellent. So it's good to know this as well. Maybe we should have started with that subject, but anyway, we know that it's come down to the mitochondria. And so for those of you out there, I may say something in Hebrew now. I don't know how many people will see it, but I just say it. למי שנפגע מזריקות של קורונה, אתם יכולים לחפש עצה ועזרה אצל דוקטור מל ליטמן. And what I just said is, for those of you out there in Israel who may got hurt from these injections, you may find some consult and help, support from Dr. Mel Liitman. Anything to add before we go on?
We'll just kind of round out the mitochondria friendly program with so we have the starting with the diet, with the detoxification, with the supplements, and also the added, if we need to, the added specific mitochondrial supplements, so we want to get all of that support in there. The psychological side too. So again, if your system is staying in this sympathetic alarm state, it also affects your mitochondria. It keeps the mitochondria in the alarm state.
Mm-hmm.
These hormones are also are danger signals to the mitochondria. So when you're maintaining that at high levels, then you're, again, that's one of the things that's not allowing you to heal. You're reinforcing the cycle. So, you have to do something there too. And that sometimes that it may be as simple as, getting exercise, having, good social contacts, and even other techniques specifically that could access the autonomic nervous system, breathing techniques, other physical stuff like Feldenkrais are things that will access the nervous system directly.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll help to get you out of the sympathetic state into that parasympathetic. So we want to try to come at it from, as many aspects as we can in order to get the result.
Absolutely. And again, the results may come, should come, and normally do come very fast. I mean, when you deal with mitochondria, the body is like, for me, it's like the body is thirsty for that. Deal with the root cause, please. Yeah. Stop with the symptoms, go to the root cause. And then the body acts and reacts really quickly. And it's really important to, because some doctors, they say, look, you do this treatment, you will feel the improvement, etc., etc. But when you deal with the mitochondria, it's days. Couple of days, I saw people with severe problems within couple of days of simple things I gave them to do, they felt improvement. And for someone who is suffering quite a lot, an improvement of 3% is a lot. Okay, mm-hmm. So we're talking about in really quick improvement.
I mean, there's also a lot of patients that I end up doing intravenous treatments with too. We want to get some really high dose nutrients quickly.
Yeah.
So we'll do, intravenous vitamin C and B vitamins and magnesium and glutathione. And these are ways to, again, just to try to get things moving quicker.
Boost. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a lot of people will feel it. Not like their booster. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And many times people will feel an effect after the first treatment. Doesn't mean they're finished, but at least they can feel something's happening.
It gives them also some hope. It gives them some energy to continue because they see the results quite fast. So it's really good. Anything else you want to add? I mean, just to, before we wrap it up, I mean, I'm really thankful for that, for this conversation. But if you want to add something, please do. I put your website address a few times in the comments. So people who are looking to get in touch with you, it's quite easy. And if you want to add something, this is the time.
No, I think we covered the main points. I think we can go on for several hours adding the stuff, but I think
probably next time. Yeah,
yeah. But we, again, I think this is covering the basic foundation. Yeah.
Excellent, Mel. Thank you very much for your expertise and your knowledge and the will to share it. And I really love your way. Thank you very much. And hopefully we'll meet soon in Yavniel.
Well, by the way, I said the main group that I've been involved with, the orthomolecular medicine group, I mean, they do have their websites too. Mm-hmm. And they do often have referral people on there internationally.
Yeah.
The other group, though, that's kind of associated with orthomolecular is functional medicine,
right?
Which some people know that the term more because they've been much better at promoting.
Yes.
So, but that'll be this. It's the same kind of approach, a similar kind of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So
and they also give emphasis on the mitochondria.
They're starting to, I think.
Exactly. When I got to know them, I was looking mitochondria. For me, for in the last 7-8 years, I realized the mitochondria is what more people need to know of to deal with that, to treat that. So when I read about the functional medicine and people told me, go and look, and yes, I'm here and I'm reading stuff and I get a lot of bits of pieces and I'm looking into them. And I couldn't see mitochondria there. So I was like, no, not for me. I want to see people who speak about mitochondria.
Yeah, I think it'll come. I mean, again, we're still dealing with an area that we're kind of in the pioneering stages with. You know, so we're still learning a lot.
Yeah.
So it takes a little while before it kind of infiltrates more, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think that is coming. And I think you'll see it coming more and more. Like I said, certainly in these fields, like I said, the orthomolecular, functional, naturopathic, these are the ones that are going to be, I think, adopting a lot more of this.
All right. I hope so. And time is of the essence. So we need to do it as quickly as possible. Right. Dr. Mel Itman, Mel, thank you very much for your time. Thank you very much for your will to share this valuable information and your knowledge. For all the audience, thank you very much for being with us. And please go to Mel's website to learn more and to get in touch with him. And we'll see you all in the next broadcast, next interview, or next pandemic. all the best to everyone. God bless us all. Thank you very much, Mel. All the best.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Bye-bye. Take care. Bye-bye.